Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast.
I'm always interested to find out why people say that they want some measure of success in life, and then they complain about what they have to do. And I was planning on doing a little teaching out on this to a group, a group that I'm teaching currently. And as I was going through material to bring to it, I decided I really love James Allen As a Man Thinketh, because I think it's the greatest book on personal responsibility ever written. It's not so much that he's telling you you have to take responsibility. He's really drawing the correlation in our minds of what happens if we do take responsibility versus what happens if we don't, and that it all starts with our thinking. And as I was going through the process of just jotting down notes to prepare for this podcast, I come across this letter that was dated September 9th, 1990. The letter is from Frank Sinatra, and it's to George Michael. And this would be probably about the height of George Michael's career. And I haven't done any other research on it, other than what I do know is that apparently there was something going on where George Michael was kind of complaining about his success. And Frank Sinatra apparently caught wind of it and either heard the interview or read the article, however it was that it was communicated. And he wrote this letter to the company that published George Michael's remarks and to George Michael himself. So I'm going to start off with reading the letter, because I think it's fantastic. And one of the things about it that I think is so fantastic is Sinatra's mindset around success and the fact that they worked and desired to be celebrities, and what he thought about George Michael's complaint around this. He said, "Dear friends, when I saw your calendar cover today about George Michael, the reluctant pop star, my first reaction was that he should thank the good Lord every morning when he wakes up to have all that he has. And that'll make two of us thanking God every morning for all that we have." He said, "I don't understand a guy who lives in hopes of reducing the strain of his celebrity status. Here's a kid who wanted to be a pop star since he was about 7 years old. And now that he's a smash performer and songwriter at 27, he wants to quit doing what tons of gifted youngsters all over the world would shoot grandma for. Just one crack at what he's complaining about. Come on, George, loosen up, swing, man, dust off the gossamer wings and fly yourself to the moon of your choice, and be grateful to carry the baggage that we've all had to carry since those lean nights of sleeping on buses and helping the driver unload the instruments. And no more talk about the tragedy of fame. The tragedy of fame is when no one shows up and you're singing to the cleaning lady in some empty joint that hasn't seen a paying customer since St. Swithin's day. And you're nowhere near that. You're top dog on the top rung of a tall ladder called stardom, which in Latin means thanks to the fans who were there when it was lonely. Talent must not be wasted. Those who have it, and you obviously do, or today's calendar cover article would have been about Rudy Valley, those who have talent must hug it, embrace it, nurture it, and share it, lest it be taken away from you as fast as it was loaned to you. Trust me, I've been there. Frank Sinatra." Now, I just think that that's fantastic. You know, I never knew Frank Sinatra, and I've heard all kinds of stories about him. I've read a couple of biographies about him. He was an interesting character, but one thing is true, is that he was, at the height of his fame, he was like Elvis and the Beatles wrapped into one. He was the biggest star our world ever knew for a significant period of time in the last century. And to hear his thought on the idea of stardom and apparently what George Michael was complaining about, I find fascinating because he's coming from this aspect of, you know, he was broke, he was down and out. His parents came from Italy. They lived in Hoboken, New Jersey. It was not the greatest place on the planet to live. And he worked his way up as from a teenager into one of the biggest singers in the world has ever known. I mean, everywhere in the world you go, people know who Frank Sinatra was. And Frank has been, he passed away in 1998. I mean, he's been gone 22 years now. He understood the effect of thought on circumstances. And you can tell by the way that he wrote this letter, he also had this intuitive idea. And I'm guessing here because he didn't actually say this, but I can't imagine what else he would be thinking in the words that he wrote. The idea of you create the quality of the circumstance by how you talk about it, how you think about it, what you actually do with it, which then brings me to James Allen, As a Man Thinketh, and the chapter on effect of thought on circumstances. So let's get into a little James Allen here and hear what the great author had to say. He said, a man's mind might be likened to a garden, which may be intelligently cultivated or allowed to run wild, but whether cultivated or neglect, it must and will bring forth. If no useful seeds are put into it, then an abundance of useless weed seeds will fall therein, and it will continue to produce their kind. You know, and that's part of the interesting thing. It's like the mind is like the earth. It's amoral. It doesn't care what you plant, but it will return whatever you plant. So in our perception, it could be good, bad. It could be beautiful. It could be ugly. It could be sick. It could be healthy. It doesn't matter what it is. Whatever we plant is going to manifest itself in our life, including the quality of our journey. Just as a gardener cultivates his plot, keeping it free from weeds and growing the flowers and the fruits which he requires, so may a man tend a garden of his mind, weeding out all the wrong, useless, and impure thoughts, and cultivating toward perfection the flowers and the fruits of right, useful, pure thoughts. By pursuing this process, a man sooner or later discovers that he is the master gardener of his soul, the director of his life. He also reveals within himself the laws of thought and understands with ever-increasing accuracy how the thought forces and the mind elements operate in the shaping of his character, his circumstances, and his destiny. Thought and character are one. Now, guys, really think about what he's saying here. Thought and character are one. And as character can only manifest and discover itself through environment and circumstance, the outer conditions of a person's life will always be found to be in harmoniously related to his inner state. So, again, if you go back and you listen to the letter from Frank Sinatra to George Michael, it's almost like Frank had this inner knowing that his thinking was creating whatever miserable state George Michael was in at the moment. Remember, at the end of the letter, he says, trust me, I've been there. Now, if you know anything about Frank Sinatra, you know that he went through several difficult periods in his life. I think he even tried to commit suicide a couple of times. He had real difficulty with his own thinking process, and he had to learn to really cultivate that to create, I would say, you know, a different environment, a different experience that he actually wanted to. He says, this does not mean that a man's circumstances at any given time are an indication of his entire character, but that those circumstances are so intimately connected with some trivial thought element within himself that for the time being, they're indispensable to his development. Every person is where they are by the law of their being. The thoughts which he has built into his character have brought him there. That means there meaning wherever you are right now. So think about where you are right now. Think about how you're experiencing where you are right now. Think about the quality of your journey. You know, it's often said in a lot of literature that there has to be this struggle, and I don't agree with that. I think that the struggle takes place until awareness replaces the struggle, because the only place struggle really happens is between our two ears. I mean, That's the deal. It is a process of not understanding the rules of thought. He said, every man is where he is by the law of his being, and the thoughts which he has built into his character have brought him there. And in the arrangement of his life, there is no element of chance, but all is the result of the law, which cannot err. Now, this is just as true of those who feel out of harmony with their surroundings as those who are contented with them. As a progressive and evolving being, man is where he is, that he may learn, that he may grow, and that as he learns the spiritual lesson which any circumstance contains for him, it passes away and gives place to other circumstances. Man is buffeted by circumstances so long as he believes himself to be the creature of an outside condition. This part's so important, so I'm going to read this one more time, because this is an awareness. This is a shift in perception for a person. Man is buffeted by circumstances so long as he believes himself to be the creature of outside conditions. But when he realizes that he is the creative power and that he may command the hidden soil and the seeds of his being out of which circumstances grow, then he becomes the rightful master of himself. The circumstances grow out of the circumstances grow out of thought every man knows who has for any length of time practiced self-control and self-purification. Now I'm going to go back to the letter here from Sinatra. Listen to the third paragraph. He says, come on, George, loosen up. Swing, man, dust off the gossamer wings and fly yourself to the moon of your choice, and be grateful to carry the baggage that we've all had to carry since those lean nights of sleeping on a bus and helping the driver unload the instruments. Now, what does that do? I mean, if you are grateful for being able to do the work that's required to achieve whatever level of success, it changes your experience. If I'm going to bitch and moan and complain, I'm going to have a miserable experience, period. That's going to be the totality of my experience. But if I change that, if I'm really grateful, if I accept the journey, whatever the journey is to get there, it literally begins to change everything. He said that circumstances grow out of every thought man knows for who has any length of time practice self-control and purification, for he will have noticed that the alteration in his circumstances has been in the exact ratio with the altered mental condition. So true is this that when man earnestly applies himself to remedy the defects in his character and makes swift and marked progress, he passes rapidly through a succession of vicissitudes. The soul attracts that which it secretly harbors and which it loves, and also that which it fears. It reaches the height of cherished aspirations. It falls to the level of unchastened desires. And circumstances are the means by which the soul receives its own. So whatever we're experiencing, the reflection of that in our life is basically this reflection of the idea of what we're carrying in our mind. I'm going to share this with everybody. I know I shared it on another podcast probably quite a long time ago, but there's a poem in the front of As a Man Thinketh, and it's really a brilliant poem. He says, mind is the master power that molds and makes, and man is mind, and evermore he takes the tool of thought, and shaping what he wills brings forth 1,000 joys, 1,000 ills. He thinks in secret, and it comes to pass. Environment is but his looking glass. Now, I remember the first time I read this, I didn't know what a looking glass was. I had to look it up, and I realized it's what they used to call a mirror. But where he talks about it thinks in secret, it is the thought processes and the paradigms that are going on in our subconscious mind that are then manifesting themselves in our physical life. He says, every thought seed sown or allowed to fall into the mind and to take root there produces its own, blossoming sooner or later into the act and bearing its own fruitage of opportunity and circumstance. Good thoughts bear good fruit, and bad thoughts bear bad fruit. The outer world of circumstance shapes itself to the inner world of thought, and both pleasant and unpleasant external conditions are factors which make for the ultimate good of the individual. As the reaper of its own harvest, man learns both by suffering and bliss. Now, he doesn't say that you have to suffer. He says man learns from it. The idea there is that we learn. Following the inmost desires, aspirations, and thoughts by which he allows himself to be dominated, pursuing the will of the wisps in pure imaginings or steadfastly walking the highway of strong and high endeavor, a man will at last arrive at the fruition and the fulfillment of the outer conditions of his life. The laws of growth and adjustment everywhere obtain, and the man does not come to the almshouse or the jail by the tyranny of fate or circumstance, but by the pathway of groveling thoughts and base desires. Nor does the pure-minded man fall suddenly into crime by stress of any mere external force. The criminal thought had long been secretly fostered in the heart, and the hour of opportunity revealed its gathered power. Circumstance does not make the man. It reveals him to himself. No such conditions can exist as descending into vice and its attendant sufferings apart from vicious inclinations, or ascending into virtue as its pure happiness without the continued cultivation of virtuous aspirations. And man, therefore, as the Lord and the master of his thought, is the maker of himself, the shaper and the author of environment. Even at birth, the soul comes to its own, and every thought, every step of its earthly pilgrimage, it attracts those combinations of conditions which reveal itself, which are reflections of its own purity and impurity, its strength and its weakness. Men do not attract what they want, but they attract that which they are. Now, let me read that one again. Men do not attract what they want, but that which they are. Their whims, fancies, ambitions are thwarted at every step, but their inmost thoughts and desires are fed with their own food, be it foul or clean. The divinity that shapes our ends is in ourselves. It is our very self. Man is manacled only by himself. Think about that. Thought and action are jailers of fate. They imprison being base. They're also angels of freedom. They liberate being noble. Not what he wishes and prays for does a man get, but what he justly earns. His wishes and prayers are only gratified and answered when they harmonize with his thoughts and actions. In the light of the truth, what then is the meaning of fight against circumstances? It means this. It means that a man is continually revolting against the effect without, while all the time he is nourishing and preserving its cause in his heart. That cause may take the form of conscious vice or unconscious weakness, but whatever it is, it stubbornly retards the effort of its possessor and thus calls aloud for a remedy. Men are anxious to improve their circumstances, but are unwilling to improve themselves. They therefore remain bound. A man who does not shrink from self-crucifixion can never fail to accomplish an object upon which his heart is set. This is as true of earthly as of heavenly things. Even the man whose sole object is to acquire wealth must be prepared to make great personal sacrifices, for he can accomplish his object and know how much more so he would do and realize a strong and well-poised life. The sacrifices are simply letting go of something of a lower nature to gain something of a higher nature. It's very often been said that successful people are willing to do what unsuccessful people are not willing to do. So if you want your free time to do something that does not really advance your life, that is just pure pleasure or joy, that's fine. But if you use all the free time to do that, you're not going to advance your life. You have to sacrifice some of your free time to learn, to get into intellectual conversation with other individuals, to really think and plan your way to where you want to go. He says, here is a man who's wretchedly poor. He is extremely anxious that his surroundings and home comforts should be improved, yet all the time he shirks his work and considers he is justified in trying to deceive his employer on the ground of the insufficiency of his wages. Such a man does not understand the simplest rudiments of those principles, which are the basis of true prosperity. It is not only totally unfitted to rise out of his wretchedness, but it's actually attracting to himself a still deeper wretchedness by dwelling in and acting out. Indolent, deceptive, and unmanly thoughts. Here is a rich man who is the victim of a painful and persistent disease as the result of gluttony. He is willing to give large sums of money to get rid of it. But he will not sacrifice his gluttonous desires. He wants to gratify his tastes for rich and unnatural viands and have his health as well. Such a man is totally unfit to have health because he has not yet learned the first principle of a healthy life. Here is an employer of labor who adopts crooked measures to avoid paying the regular wage and, in the hope of making a larger profit, reduces the wage of his workpeople. Such a man is altogether unfitted for prosperity, and when he finds himself bankrupt, both as regards of reparation of and riches, he blames circumstances, not knowing that he is the sole author of his condition. I have introduced these three cases merely as an illustrative of the truth that man is the causer, though nearly always unconsciously, of his circumstances, and that while aiming at the good end, is continually frustrating its accomplishment by encouraging thoughts and desires which cannot possibly harmonize with that end. Such cases could be multiplied and varied almost indefinitely, but this is not necessary. As the reader can, if he so resolves, trace the action of the laws of thought of his own mind and life. Until this is done, mere external facts cannot serve as a ground of reasoning. And that's what people do. They rationalize and reason based on factual evidence that they have in their life, and they associate that factual evidence to proof of why they're winning or not winning, which then creates a major, major issue, because if the person is not winning and they do not understand that they're causing it, those facts deepen, they broaden, they get bigger. Circumstances, however, are so complicated, thought is so deeply rooted, and the conditions of happiness vary so vastly with individuals, that a man's entire soul condition, though it may be known of himself, cannot be judged by another from an external aspect of his life alone. A man may be honest in certain directions, yet suffer privations. A man may be dishonest in certain directions, yet acquire wealth. But the conclusion usually formed that one man fails because of his particular honesty and the other prospers because of his particular dishonesty is the result of a superficial judgment, which assumes that the dishonest man is almost totally corrupt and the honest man is almost entirely virtuous. In the light of the deeper knowledge and wider experience, such judgment is found to be completely erroneous. The dishonest man may have some admirable virtues, which the other does not possess, and the honest man obnoxious vices, which that's absent of the other. The honest man reaps the good result of his honest thoughts and acts. He also brings upon himself the sufferings which his vices produce. The dishonest man likewise garners his own suffering and happiness. It's pleasing to human vanity to believe that one suffers because of one's virtue, but not until a man has expatted every stickly bitter and impure thought from his mind and washed every sinful stain from his soul can he be in a position to know and declare that his sufferings are the result of his good and not of his bad qualities. And on the way to, yet long before he has reached that supreme perfection. He will have found, working in his mind and his life, the great law, which is absolutely just, and which cannot, therefore, give good for evil, evil for good. Possessed of such knowledge, he will then know, looking back upon his past ignorance and blindness, that his life is and always was justly ordered, and that all of his past experiences, good and bad, were equitable outworking of his evolving yet unevolved self. Good thoughts and actions can never produce bad results. Bad thoughts and actions can never produce good results. But saying that nothing can come from corn but corn and nothing from nettles but nettles, men understand this law in the natural world and work with it, but few understand it in the mental and moral world, though its operation there is just as simple and undeviating, and they therefore do not cooperate with it. I think that is just fantastic. Now, he goes on in this chapter. There's one more quote, one more thing that I want to end with here, because I think it's really important, because it's also a study of the laws, like the universal laws. And I don't know that somebody like Frank would have known that. He may have known it. I don't know. But I think that he knows some of the basic laws of life. He says here in the book, he says, law, not confusion, is the dominating principle in the universe. Justice, not injustice, is the sole substance of life, and righteousness, not corruption, is the molding and moving force in the spiritual government of the world. This being so, man has bought to right himself to find that the universe is right. And during the process of putting himself right, he will find that he alters his thoughts toward things and toward people. Things and other people will alter toward him. That's beautiful. Let me just leave you with this one sentence, this one paragraph here that I think is so important, the way Sinatra closed this out. Because we all have talent. And we all have purpose. Talent must not be wasted. Those who have it, and you obviously do, or today's calendar cover would have been about Rudy Valley, those who have talent must hug it, embrace it, nurture it, and share it, lest it be taken away from you as fast as it was loaned to you. Trust me, I've been there, Frank Sinatra. This is David Nagel. I hope you get a lot out of this. You should listen to this as many times as you can. It is really, really rich. And this is a lesson that'll continue to change your life no matter where you are in your own progress. Make it a great day, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.